I'm Stargate Pioneer from Legends of S.H.I.E.L.D., a podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the one you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready, because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
This is Paul McGann,
the Eighth Doctor. You're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Go and throw yourself under a bus.
I didn't mean to say that. He told me to say that.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten. Did you just say womp womp? And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I like it with the helmet on.
And Keir Hansen.
And that's why, to this day, I can't eat cotton candy.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 198 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where just like Hamlet told the players, we ask you to speak the speech just as we taught you, musically and smoothly. If you exaggerate the words the way some actors do, we might as well have some newscaster read the lines. Don't use too many hand gestures, just do a few, gently, like this. When you get into a whirlwind of passion on stage, remember to keep the emotion moderate and smooth. You know, like Shatner. And with me today we have Keir Hansen, and only Keir Hansen. How are you today, Keir?
I am great. Can't wait to do this podcast tonight, yes.
So much emotion.
My emotions. Well, this week we are reflecting on some of the most iconic speeches that the Doctor has given us. Looking to kind of ask ourselves, which are the ones that continue to strike that stirring chord in our hearts? And within those speeches, is it really a matter of the written word that it gives it all its strength, or is it the actor's delivery, or some balance of both, and to what extent? So, you know, we see this current trend right now taking place at conventions where one doctor's script is handed to another actor to do a cold read. And while this trend continues, does this really serve to bolster the admiration of the text itself, or make the talent who was handed the script really shine under pressure? Or does it, as some people have criticized, even undermine the appreciation of the original actor's work? So, 52 years of great dialogue and monologues, we've got a lot we can tap into. But there are certain ones that I guess you could say could really, really represent the Doctor's persona in the full span, or maybe just individual iterations. So, do we want to tackle these chronologically, or just the ones that really kind of jump to your mind first? How do you want to approach them?
I don't care.
We could even work backwards, really. I mean, this is like the stuff that's freshest in mind is obviously.
Well, the ones that popped immediately to mind were Matt Smith's, just because it's so iconic for him to do the big speech.
Yeah. Seems like they gave him, looking back historically, just in terms of the sheer amount of uninterrupted screen time.
Mm-hmm.
He had some of the longest monologues.
But, in prepping for this week, it wasn't just him. It was that era, because Amy Pond had some big speeches. Mm-hmm. River had some big speeches. So yeah. It was kind of the style of the time to let people go on by themselves for a while.
Yeah, I gotta wonder. There's a premise for that, and I guess I feel that maybe it's by the time he got around to about the sixth, seventh series that Moffat and the writers that he would tap into felt that it was necessary to have these kinds of sermons on the mount occasionally, or like in River's case, you think of. What was it when they were at the Demon's Run and they're doing, the good man goes to war and it's got the voiceover and such, and that Amy Pond's
and, well, and then
one.
She had the big speech at the end of that episode, too, about how, he's changed the meaning of the Doctor.
Right. I'm thinking also about it's not necessarily a monologue, but, Rory Takes actually has a moment where he has a pretty long closure towards the end of Angels Take Manhattan, where he's, you know, discussing, you know, standing on the building's edge and talking to Amy about, you know, that, well, if the paradox is true, then this won't really matter. And he's trying to reason it out and, you know, tell me, you know, I've died often enough. I know how this works, you know. So, yeah, we've kind of gotten into a pattern of this. But I guess in my research, I wanted to go back and really kind of obviously tap into a bit of the classic era as well, mm-hmm. where, you know, a lot of the monologues weren't exactly speeches. They were more conversations where the Doctor was really trying to address another character. Typically, well, I should say at least most of the examples that I had come across, as a result of him trying to console them or gain their confidence or calm them down or something of that sort. Or in the Sixth Doctor's case, really, you know, tear them up one side and down the other. But why don't we take this sort of a little bit chronologically, because okay. then that'll get us right towards the Smith and Capaldi era where this is really hitting full steam.
All right, let's go for it.
Well, we're kind of fortunate because a lot of the rewatches that we were doing touched on some of these stories that that I pulled some of the examples from. And one was obviously when we were talking about the First Doctor saying farewell to Susan, you know, at the close of the Dalek invasion of Earth, you know, and he's got that whole speech about, you know, I want you to live a normal life as best you can. You know, you've earned this for yourself. Don't worry, I'll come back for you.
Which is one of the first classic episodes that I saw, that scene at least. Mm-hmm.
Right. And it kind of gives you an interesting impression of Hartnell's Doctor that really flies in the face of some of the broad stroke definitions that people make of him. Oh, he's spiky and he's cold and he's difficult to reason with and he has all this disdain for others and so forth. And it really, if you were to just walk into that, you'd have a totally different impression from the jump. Mm-hmm. So I'm very glad they gave him that opportunity. And it wasn't really that long into his tenure either. So kind of dispels that whole myth. And it's been quoted so often because the whole idea of the I shall come back is this sort of, you know, premonition for the regeneration before they even thought of it. Yeah. And of course, leaving that whole idea on the hook. When is he exactly going back for Susan? When is this going to happen? Well, it happened in the audio anyway. Next instance we had was actually from another one of our rewatches when we got a chance to enjoy Tomb of the Cybermen just in the last couple episodes. So the Second Doctor talking to Victoria, and obviously she's reflecting on how she misses her father. And you get this great moment, rather brief, but it's a very insightful moment for the Doctor because it's not just a matter of, you know, if Hartnell had that moment of paternal or, you know, grandpaternal protective nature, then now we've got something where he actually dips into his past a little bit. We get a little bit of his background, tiny, but just that little bit about him remembering his family, which I'm sure set fans at the time really wondering where else this goes.
And I haven't seen a ton of the Second Doctor yet, but it seems like the big speech wouldn't really be his style as much, that this would kind of be a little more isolated.
I think it has to do a lot with the kind of rapport that he has with his companions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he seemed to go back and forth with people a lot more than other doctors might.
I think that was kind of intentional. It's sort of the nature of a lot of Troughton's conversational style is, and again, we're going to talk about this a lot tonight. It's the fact that the writers really started writing to their doctor. Mm-hmm. And if Troughton is the type where he's at his most comfortable asking questions and guiding his companions to solutions by getting them to think and reason things through and respond and contribute to the conversation, then that's his strength. And so it's going to be that volley. But all the time, he's steering the conversation rather than just pontificating. sort of a sidestep, there's a great example. This was actually something I had been talking on Facebook with one of our listeners, Don Cleese, and he was trying, or was it Don? No, I'm sorry. It was Ian, who was trying to remember which Third Doctor speech where he and Joe were talking about how bleak the outcome, you know, everything was going to descend into chaos and everything, you know, time was going to unravel and, you know, their usual routine, you know, if we don't solve this, the world and the universe as we know it collapses. And Joe's just looking. Yeah, she's just looking at us. Well, it sounds kind of bleak when you put it that way. And he gives her this odd little story about this hermit that lived under a tree near their house as he was growing up. It's this little Gallifreyan childhood story. And he goes on and on about this thing, about this hermit that had sort of reached this natural peace by finding the beauty in these little wildflowers and such. And it was really an unusual moment. I credit Ian for helping me remember this. It was just a matter of a total left turn of the highway. And it throws Joe. I mean, she actually kind of makes fun of him. She's like, the secret of life is a daisy? He's like, well, yeah, but okay, I realize it's kind of silly and everything, but, you know, it's finding the beauty in the little things. And if you can find the beauty in even just the little things, it makes the larger dangers seem less formidable. So it's him starting to use his softer moments. So I guess those seem to be more of the examples that I saw within the first, you know, three Doctors, and even some instances with Baker as well. There's some honorable mentions in there where instead of the angry genius, he's most impressive in his softer moments. But then we get to one where obviously there's no softness to it. This becomes a real introspection. And I wouldn't really consider this a speech, but we had to absolutely include it because it's just iconic dialogue. It's almost as if the Doctor's reasoning it through on his own. Sarah Jane just happens to be there to punctuate the conversation. And that's obviously the moment within Genesis of the Daleks where we're looking at the two wires and the possibility to be able to eradicate the Dalek race early on. We're not even going to paraphrase it. Everyone knows it very well. So, and if you don't know it well, please just go absorb it, watch it over and over and over again, or just read the transcripts because it's very powerful off the page. So you got a chance to see this one, correct? We were doing a lot of our Davros episodes and kind of looking at
it. I think so, but it's been a while.
All right. So, but you know, it's one of those things where even the way the camera is framed, it's just him staring down at those two wires. Sarah's almost talking at the side of his head and trying to ration, you know, and reason with him to say, you know, yep, you shouldn't even have to think about this. It's like bacteria. If you got a chance to eradicate it, you get rid of it.
Yeah, I remember that because then we talked about it again when he did have the opportunity to kill Child Davros.
Right.
This specific chunk.
Yep. So You have to wonder. I mean, that's now another side of the Doctor that that really starts to come together in the, you know, that defining phrase for him, you know, neither cruel nor cowardly and so forth. But if you really take that to the fullest extent of that mantra, that also means that genocide is not within his nature either, no matter how you may choose to justify it. You know, in any side's mind, genocide is justified to them. So he can't fall into that particular trap. And yet it continues to rattle him even up through the Capaldi era when he's dealing with that opportunity to be able to alter the course of time. Now, I wanted to make sure that before we got too far off of the classics, I had to put in here something where it was really someone getting dressed down, and you couldn't handle that any better than handing the reins to Colin Baker, the Sixth Doctor, on that. So a while back when we got a chance to do Trial of the Time Lord and all the episodes involved with that, 16 episodes that go along with that whole series, there's a point where he has now had to deal with the ridiculous accusations from the Valyard. He's had to deal with the Time Lords and the Inquisitor trying to tear him apart for the very laws that they themselves flaunt to their own gains. And then the added insult to injury of having the Master brought in to the proceedings to testify against him on behalf of the Time Lords. So he has had it. He has absolutely had it. And he's starting to just boil in the box as he's sitting there on trial, and he finally gets to that point where he's got the a lot of people don't seem to have the patience to go through a lot of the Trial of the Time Lord because of the sheer length of it, and if they're not really Colin Baker fans, you got to kind of muscle through it. But there are payoffs. I swear to you, there are payoffs in the series. But when he gets into this, is where you really, really see the disdain that he has for his own species, and it's rough. I can't think of another Doctor prior to this, prior to Baker, that they could have handed that to and get away with it without it feeling really foreign. You know, talk about writing to your doctor. Have you read over that little clip?
That little bit there. It's you can see that Tennant was calling on this when the Time Lords came back.
Yeah, by all means. I think that's exactly what the kind of animosity he was tapping into. Eccleston took a little bit of a break from it because of the remorse that was still carrying upon him.
Right. Well, and but, at that point, he had so much hatred for the Dalek, there wasn't much left for anything else.
Right. So by the time we start getting around to Rassilon's return and 10th Doctor realizing that these jerks are still out there, and they're even jerkier than they were before, then he starts to pull from that. And I think we're going to see quite a bit of a return to this if we have Gallifrey's return now going into Series 10. I think if he has to deal with any more Time Lord bureaucracy, yeah, you're going to have Malcolm Tucker in a Time Lord collar, which is going to be insane. Oh, I need to work on that cosplay.
We're going to learn some Gallifreyan swear words. It'll be awesome.
Spacking. It's all spacking. So now we get ourselves up into modern Who, our post-2005 Who. And, you know, if we're going to take this chronologically and we start looking into the Ninth Doctor, I happen to grab one in particular that stood out in my mind, but you may have others that you thought were kind of indicative of where Eccleston was in his mindset. I happen to particularly latch on to his closing moment because I thought that was a pretty powerful statement back that really encompassed what Ninth Doctor was about in his farewell to Rose, or his kind of final statements to her in Parting of the Ways. But I don't know. I mean, it's when you consider Ninth's persona and writing for Eccleston, you know, you've got that, and then you've got way back at the start, you've got in Rose. So you kind of bookend it. I could have grabbed from either end. But you've got his whole speech in Rose where he's talking about, we're falling through space, you know, clinging to the skin of this little world. And if we let go, that's what the whole idea. I can feel the earth turning, you know, and I can feel the planet hurtling around the sun. Which would you say is kind of more the way you reflect on Eccleston's Doctor?
I think I remember him more towards the end just because I started feeling his character more as you got to know him better. So I remember the final scene more than I remember the beginning.
Okay, yeah. And for those, just so listeners know what we're prefacing here, this is the whole idea about the where he tells Rose, obviously the enemy can't get a hold of this machine.
It's the hologram after he's locked her in the TARDIS.
Right, yeah, he duped her in there as the TARDIS is taking her back, and he's saying, just leave it there, let it gather dust, and, you know...
Live your life.
Exactly. Have a fantastic life. He has to end on fantastic. I'd probably say that's a bit of a coin toss, whether you look at it as far as the weariness that we come into meeting him, and everything that's on his shoulders... that is just literally pulling him to the ground. And hence he feels the earth moving and he feels the planet spinning because he's so in tune with everything because he's been hollowed out. Or you've got him towards the end of the run or at the end of his particular run where he's reflecting on the fact that she has restored his faith in this one small thing, the value of the human life and tells her, make the absolute most of it. Let the rest of this all fall to dust. So, I think it's a great bookend for him, as we get into to Tennant's run, you've got a number of opportunities you can tap into. I don't know, what would you say?
Well, the one that pops immediately to mind for me, I don't know if you would consider it a big speech, but it was kind of a big speech, was the one in Blink.
Okay.
I mean, they make t-shirts of that one.
The whole idea of the linear progression and so forth, but that's... That, I think, is a great encapsulation of his whimsy and the fact that he's just this really hyper-intelligent, brilliantly immature lunatic. Right. And that kind of sums it all up. He can't even grasp, he can't find words half the time to fit the chaos that's going on in his mind. So you get wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey. This is the best thing he can come up with at the moment. So he's got, but you got also opportunities like things like, when he's talking about in the Satan pit, You know, and he's got that whole thing about, you know, he realizes he's been trapped, that it's a trap, that if he lets his companion die, you know, then, or if he kills the beast, then his companion dies as well. And he says, but if I kill you, I kill her. But that implies that she's just a victim. And then he goes on to say, and this is funny, it's almost reminiscent of what you start getting in the or the buildup into what we'll talk about later with Rings of Akaten. He's like, you know, I've seen fake gods and bad gods and demigods and would-be gods. I've had the whole pantheon around, but I only believe in her, you know. And so it's like it builds upon what Eggleston started to establish about the value of his companion's life and their the role that they fulfill within him, their side of that symbiotic relationship. And it transcends any of these massive powers that he's come into contact with over the centuries. So It's definitely built upon that theme. Which one did we put in the notes? Which one did we grab for?
The Waters of Mars.
Okay. Oh yeah. But the which was kind of unusual. I know it gets referenced a lot, but when you watch it and you see the delivery on it, it's a little haphazard because it's done in voiceover. It's almost done as like a clip sequence. You know, it grabs from different spoken moments, so it lacks a little bit of continuity. I think I hate to say that I would have done it a little differently, but I think if they let him do it in one take and stuck it, I think it might have been even more powerful. Because written, it actually flows really beautifully. It's a little staccato in the way that you see it done as he's in the orange moon suit and he's climbing his way across the burning rubble and so forth as all the base stations in panic and such. But this is him bearing his soul about, you know, being left as the last of the Time Lords and how that has weighed upon him for who knows how long. I mean, this is him laying it bare, and I think it deserved to have more punch than it got. Maybe it's just me, but
like if they had framed it and delivered it the way they've done some of Matt Smith's big speeches.
Oh yeah, yeah. If they gave him some moment where, you know, he's crawling across the sands, and, you know, the orange sands, and he's just, you know, he's talking into his headset,
sweeping up around him.
Absolutely. It would have been an absolute, you know, heartbreaker moment. Because, you know, he would have wept through it because it's Tennant.
The hair emoting like mad.
In a helmet.
Yeah. How is it blowing? There's no breeze in there.
It's sentient. It's like a sentient cloud, only it's sentient hair. I also wanted to just give honorable mention to his swan song. Well, it's not his actual final closing speech, but it's one of his final exchanges that he has with Wilf after being irradiated or about to be irradiated at the end of time. You know, and he's having that discussion with Wilf about where you see how much it's weighing upon him because he has found somebody who was so wrapped up in him and fascinated and enthralled with everything that he represented, that he put himself in harm's way, despite the Doctor's attempts to do the absolute opposite. And he's sort of scolding, but praising Wilf at the same time for, you know, you had to go and get stuck because that's who you are, you know, waiting for me all this time. You're not remotely important, but I could have done so much more, you know, and it's just... It's a horrible, horrible thing to go through as a viewer. These were rough. This week sucked. I'm just going to put this out there. There's a lot of dust flying around the house, and I had to take a lot of moments. But this is one that kind of kills me. Even before you get to the entire, you know, I don't want to go line, because it's just the whole. It's him looking back and saying, you know what, this is. I could have done everything. I had all the right intentions. I've done all the right things. And it's still coming back to kick me in the ass.
Yeah.
So it's... yeah. That's still my Tennant moment. I wouldn't call it a speech, but I think as far as a kind of a monologue, you know, Wilf has a couple interjections in there once in a while, but I think the Doctor is just speaking right over him.
Right, he's going.
He has a piece to say. But it's if that is kind of where we see the Doctor when he is, this is where we really start traveling with some serious Dark Doctor, you know. And this closes the book on the Dark Doctor as we snap into Smith, and Smith immediately quick, get this guy a companion, and make it cheery, because this last 6 months or so has been really creepy.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we know it's bad when the Doctor travels alone.
Yeah. Which, again, that, you know, goes along to, you know, we didn't really kind of you can get it, as we're getting into 11th Doctor. I mean, we could jump ahead a little bit and say, you know, when he gets the whole warning is it Name of the Doctor or Day of the Doctor, where he actually gets told by the vision of Amy never to travel alone. You know what you're like when you're alone, kind of thing.
No,
I want to say that's Day of.
Wasn't that in the epilogue of Angels Take Manhattan?
Well, she does put it she puts something to that effect in the afterword, yes. But isn't there also in the anniversary episode, where that whole, it gets brought up again, because that's the carryover into Clara having to take the phone call from the 11th Doctor at Terenzalore, saying, look after him. Is that the Doctor out there? Is that the Doctor on the phone? And they have that nice little exchange.
I don't remember, but I remember seeing it there, so I'm not sure.
Yep. Well, one of the ones that I'd say, again, as we mentioned, Smith got the big Sermon on the Mount speeches on a regular basis. Mm. We had some listeners who didn't take kindly to that. They said, you know, it's just an opportunity for squeaky Smith to scream out, you know, some lines and spit, literally spit at times.
And then do the big arms wide, come at me, bro stance at the end.
Sort of half come at me, bro, half Jesus out there. But for all of the criticism, I think what they wrote for him, whether or not you're particularly fond of the delivery, I think what they wrote for him during those instances was exceptional, right off the page. Even includes Akaten, which I will not consider to be one of my, you know, my top 10 episodes. But that moment.
Yeah, it's a good scene.
It's an outstanding scene.
The little girl singing and him doing the big thing.
Yeah, we'll leave the flash mob crowd sing-along out of it. How do they all know the language? Anyway, but before we get to Akaten, well, all right, we'll mention Akaten. We'll get through this. We'll motor through it. Yeah. Because this is one, obviously, that is like probably the quintessential showdown speech. Because I think it pulls upon a lot of what we've just referenced in a lot of his predecessors. A lot of work went into this particular speech to reference the relationships on the positive side, the torment on the dark side, the anguish on the embattled side of the Doctor. And you see all these facets that he's had to contend with, and we've seen referenced in previous speeches, and he's nailing them all, good, bad, and ugly, and then he just throws it all back at the pumpkin god and says, you know, this is knowledge that will make parasite gods, you great pumpkin, blaze.
And then it doesn't work out so well, but
here's the thing, and I know I might have mentioned this when we first watched this thing back when it originally aired. There is one line in this speech that bugs the hell out of me. And I know they did it just for Smith because it's just the nature of Smith and his unpredictable kind of goofiness. But the take it all, baby.
Yeah.
Baby. It's like all of a sudden we're, you know, Dirty Dancing or something. I don't... You could have left that out, you know, and just said, take it all, have it, you have it all. Leave out just that one line, take it all, baby. And it would have been absolute level the house, mic drop, dust, clouds, you know, shake the foundations. But that, for me, ooh, pulled me right back.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. Backing up, though, I think the the one I think that tipped that started it all. Well, no, you know what? There's one in here that I didn't include. But before we get to the Pandorica, because everyone tends to talk about the Pandorica, is actually from 11th Hour, which I think was a great sort of lead-in. It was a sort of a mini-speech. It was a whole, the basically run that he says to Prisoner Zero, you know, as we're watching, you know, all of the hologram, you know, views of the, of his predecessor Doctor incarnations, and you know, he's giving the whole, let's see if I can remember basically the whole gist of it. It's very similar to this kind of a of this exact speech. So it's, you know,
Tennant had a similar one to this speech in The Runaway Bride.
Did he?
Or was it not The Runaway Bride? This world is protected. What episode was that in?
Oh, no. That was Capaldi. That was Capaldi in Flatline.
No. Tennant had a similar speech, though. I don't remember when it was. Or was it his first episode?
Oh, I don't know. I'd have to look back. I mean, because I remember, obviously, I mean, when you talk about the protected, that's literally, I think, almost word for word, that's the choice of phrases that Capaldi uses against the Boneless in Flatline. Mm. Is that, you know, whatever dimension you're from, however you see us, just remember
it was when Tennant called back whatever alien was trying to destroy Earth that week to scold them.
Right.
I don't remember which episode it was, though. Anyways, Smith.
Yeah. Huh. So, yeah, I guess with Smith, whether it's, well, out of those two, whether you take the Big Bang or the Pandorica opens, because they gave him two. I mean, they apparently, this was just, I don't know what they were thinking for this one. They really wanted to put him through the paces on these two episodes. Because with Pandorica opens, obviously, with the whole, you know, ask yourself, you know, let someone else go first kind of thing. Think back on all the times you tried.
Every dark day.
And who was that pain in the ass who was always there to screw up your plans? Hello. But they give him in the Big Bang that whole speech about the where he believes he's saying goodbye to Amy. You know, the Dr. and Amy Pond, the days that never came. You know, the crack of the wall that's closing up, and he gives that whole you know, live well, love Rory, bye bye Pond. But it's a long speech as he's talking to the sleeping Amelia. And that's where obviously we got that quote that we love to use so much about the, you know, we're all stories in the end. I don't know. I think by the time they hit Smith's era, they had such a wealth of resources to tap into as far as some of the things that had been proven by his predecessors. Some of these moments, these speeches, or these introspective moments that had so much power, that they gave him an opportunity to play with a Rubik's Cube of them on any given speech and just have a little bit of green, a little bit of red, a little bit of yellow. Whether or not you feel that's it was effective kind of depends on your opinion of Smith. I know we had some folks that chimed in with us that were either, you know, kind of condemning or defending in that particular regard. Nicole had tweeted in and said that the Rings of Occam's speech was one of her personal favorites and that she felt that Smith really owned it. And Tim came in on Facebook and said that, you know, his big speeches, Smith's big speeches, were some of the best overall. But we've had other folks who had chimed in and said that, you know, if you could hand these speeches, I think Don had said on Facebook, that if you handed the speech from the end of day to the doctor to anyone else, it fits some of his cohorts very well. You know, we heard Paul McGann in, like I said, one of these conventions where he had been handed that, and obviously he happened to kill it because he's been doing so much audio work lately that he can cold read these things and find it on first read that are fascinating. Mm-hmm. But think about Capaldi now, as far as when you're writing for him, what do you think are the aspects that from either speeches that he's been given, that, you know, we'll get to the iconic one that we've had to date, or anything else that you would give to him where his character is right now? What are you playing to as a writer? What do you want to try to draw out of him that you think has the most serious screen impact?
Well, I think you've got to play into the fact that some people do find him kind of abrasive. So when you give him a big speech, he's kind of got to be going at somebody with it.
Okay. Even Yeah, I suppose. I'm trying to think if there are any instances where he straddles the line, and you get something where he's angry about something, but at the same time he's trying to find the better side. I guess if we look at this piece that we're referring to, you know, where he's talking to Clara Z and the which of the Zygon is Inversion.
Inversion was the last one, I think.
Yeah, I keep getting Inversion, right? Second one.
Yeah, the invasion.
Where he's really dealing
first.
With them all.
Yeah.
Yeah, and nobody knows, you know, who's human, who's Zygon, and so forth. So he decides he's gonna tear everybody apart, and he gives a whole speech about, you know, calling them just like a child throwing a temper tantrum. Just, you know, any warmonger is really just a matter of being caused by the troublemakers. So, you know, your revolution is just going to be the basis for anger for the next one, which I think is exceptional for 12th. And I think that's one of the reasons, you know, Jay didn't get a chance to join us tonight, but this is his particular, you know, go-to speech. And it's the one that really locked him in with Capaldi. But I think that's because it has obviously the dressing down of the Zygon, but at the same time, he's begging, pleading for some sanity in this situation. Mm. But he's doing so in a very 12th Doctor way. I'm going to belittle the hell out of you, and hopefully you're going to see things in a kinder light.
Yeah. I'm going to get Malcolm. You to do the right thing, but I'm not going to be nice about it.
His real soft moments, I got to think there's also, you know, he's had the times, you know, in the closing moments with Clara, some of those final exchanges that he would have with Clara and things, you know, or the whole point in the arc about the good man, mm-hmm. where you really see him kind of hollowed out, or listen, you know, where you can see that he's dealing with something that's rattling him at a deep level. He was actually the one on the receiving end of a number of really good monologues. Mm-hmm. I know Clara had that great, where she when she was talking to the child doctor. You know, in the barn, gives him the little soldier figure, and has a whole discussion about fear and how fear can be used as something
as
that brings it. Yeah, so I think that is where we are, kind of right now. This is a matter of so much role reversal that happened within the last season or two that we now have these opportunities for Capaldi to be on the receiving end of some of these, because he's now on the upward swing of a learning curve. He's relearning how to gain back some of those aspects of his predecessor personas that made him not necessarily softer or squishier, but
more compassionate.
Yeah, well, you know, it's the catching more flies with honey at times.
Yeah,
you know, she or some of the supporting companions had to sort of jump in at times over these last couple of series to be the rescue. By being his caretaker, I'm going to use the nice words because he's apparently incapable of it. So he has to relearn those skills. So that's kind of why I'm fascinated to see exactly what kind of a relationship we're going to have with Bill as Bill.
Yeah.
So, well, I can't.
The best part about having somebody else give the monologue to 12 is he's got such an interesting face to just listen with.
Mm.
He can emote so much without talking. It's really interesting to watch.
Yeah, I forget which one of the speeches it is, but I want to say that it was just towards the midpoint of this past series where Clara's kind of laying into him on something. Or actually, it might have been a shoulder when she was... was it from The Woman Who Lived? I'll have to check. I'm going to watch this one again. He's basically on the receiving end of about a 4-minute diatribe. Mm. And he's actually reserved enough to just take it without interjecting. But you see his face go from the defiance. It's all in the eyebrows.
Yeah.
It goes from the defiance as the, you know, how dare you be fine. You want to get it out of your system? It's, sure, go ahead. You know, say what you got to say. It really has no merit whatsoever. And then it kind of, you know, one or two lines kind of hits. And, you know, one eyebrow, let's go. And then another line kind of smack, you know, a little uppercut in there, a little body blow. And you can see him just sort of wearing it down. But he never totally softens. He comes all the way around the curve and realizes that he's been letting his guard down too much. He's letting too much in. And it kind of riles back up again. I love it. So there are loads of honorable mentions that we didn't include in here. You know, some of the ones that some people had suggested to when they were writing in. You know, obviously, Eccleston's speech at the end of Bad Wolf. Thanks, Don, for recommending that one in particular. And then we have we could probably do a whole other episode entirely as far as other characters' monologues. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously the ones we addressed. You know, whether it be Rose has had her moment, Clara's had her moment. Donna had never gotten her moment. Donna never got a great monologue of any substance.
No, she had great lines, but she never really got to carry the big speech.
Right. Yeah. Which is why, if you get an opportunity in the new 10th Doctor Adventures from Big Finish, there obviously since it's 10th and Tennant. Or I'm sorry, 10th and Tate, then you've got an opportunity for her. She gets to go off on some tears for a while, sometimes angry, yeah. And sometimes really insightful for her character that I think are really valuable. I think it's a good opportunity for to give her. I think Jenny Colgan in particular gives her a phenomenal opportunity to kind of explain why she's just not satisfied. As much as traveling and as much of the adventures that she's been given, she still hasn't. Still hasn't found what she's looking for. I can hear YouTube singing in the back of my head right now. But yeah. So we'll see what's going to go forward. Obviously, with Bill in the mix, if she's going to be a kind of a bright-eyed, sure, show me anything kind of companion, and it's all about the adventuring, then we may not get as many of these sort of little softer moments. It might just be, you know, if we get any speeches, they're probably going to be thrown at whoever our big bad is for the week. But I'm hoping that they put enough dimension behind Bill's character that she gets to bring new things out of Capaldi as well. Well, out of the 12th Doctor. Not like you could ask for anything more out of Capaldi personally. More hair. And grow the beard back because it's awesome.
More eyebrow.
Just hair, beard, eyebrows, hair, just everything, just fuzz, miles and miles of fuzz. So, figure we tackle the news for tonight?
We probably should.
Well, in a typical feat of Moffat-splaining, and I don't understand why it is. This is probably the third or fourth reference to this article within Doctor Who magazine where they've titled it that Moffat is explaining the return of Matt Lucas's character Nardole for Series 10.
I think it's because the editor keeps changing Moffat-splaining in the titles.
Oh, I started typing Moffat-splaining again. I got to change it back. Explains. Moffat explains. I'm going to autocorrect. Keep putting those words together. So... for those of you who have gotten the latest issue of Doctor Who magazine, curse you, because it always takes me an extra 5 weeks to get one here in the States. 5 weeks! 5 weeks! Even electronically, it takes like 3 weeks. But he had said, he quotes, you know, "I decided that Nardole should return to Doctor Who, and Matt Lucas got in touch saying, 'I loved being in the show, can I come back?'" You know, so essentially, Lucas begged to have another opportunity added, as I'm sure a lot of guest stars have done. But Lucas does have exceptional comedic talents. He's got great chops. He's got good timing. And I think Moffat has seen an opportunity to take an extremely popular comedic talent and utilize the hell out of him. Am I alone in saying I think my only concern is that there is a really good explanation as to why he's still there?
Yeah, I don't think they understand what explains means.
Okay, because there is no explanation.
No, it's just like, he asked if he could come back, and I said yes. That is the explanation we are given.
Yeah, that's... unless the follow-up line where he says, where Moffat says of Lucas, "He is of my kind, he belongs to our world." So I decided to import the best comic timing I've ever seen into Doctor Who on a regular basis. So it's not just going to be for a couple episodes. He's going to be interspersed throughout. Mm-hmm. Regular basis says to me, more than two.
Yeah.
So, I don't. But that's not an explanation.
No.
It's a justification at that, if that.
He's basically just confirming that, yes, he is in the season.
Yeah. Moffat confirms Lucas was in front of the camera for the filming of Series 10 episodes.
Yep.
Good-o. Another piece here. I'm sort of switch up the order of what we had it because I want to save my favorite piece for the last here. So we do have a little bit more of a confirmation on the window for the broadcast date for class. We are now into the month, at least, and we'll say we're going to see it in October. Whether you're seeing it in the UK on BBC Three or here North America on BBC One or
BBC America.
BBC, sorry. Because, yeah, they did say they were going to do simultaneous releases so that we don't have to worry about any sort of a stagger. You'll get it in October. We don't know exactly what day or what time slot they're going to put it in. So I'm hoping, based on, well, if they want to try to continue the conditioning on it, it should be a Saturday evening thing. I think they should just continue with what they would normally do for the Doctor Who slot. Just keep people accustomed to having something within the Hooniverse.
I figured they would, because they're going after the same audience, pretty much, maybe a little younger, but you'd think they'd probably stick to the same time frame.
Yeah. Oh, I saw some article tweeted the other day saying, I think it might have been even IO9 that said, the Doctor Who, or the spinoff class, how did they phrase it? They said, spinoff show class to be just like Torchwood without the mature content. And I said, so basically it's Doctor Who.
Yeah. Because so, Torchwood is Doctor Who with mature content.
Yeah, so back off that a little bit. There you go. It just happens to have kids and trainers. But yeah, so we're hoping to hear more. I'm sure we're going to get more because over the next month and a half, as we go through September and early October, we know Ness is going to be making a lot of appearances at conventions, many of them here stateside. So that's probably leading up to a huge press junket and release date, I would assume, probably for about mid-October, maybe right around the time that the whole series of them are going to be appearing at the New York Comic Con, as we reported last week. So that'd make a lot of sense from a marketing angle. Strike when the iron's at its absolute hottest. So this last bit, I got all excited.
And then he read the byline.
You know, so you set up these alerts on the news feeds so that the little monsters that work behind RSS hand you things and say, oh, there's key phrases and terms that you're watching for. This looks important, boss. Here, read this. And my phone blows up and says all these amazing things like, confirmed, lost episodes to be animated, and da-da-da-da-da. And you get so excited because we thought it was all rumor mill last week, and we went, oh my God, power of the Daleks. It's finally happening. But your only source of reference for this information is the frickin' Daily... The Mirror.
Yeah.
Not even the Daily Star. The Mirror.
Citing
worse.
Absolutely no sources.
None.
So,
themselves.
Yeah. I think they watched the same clip we saw and then wrote an article about how it's coming.
It's just... It's the worst form of clickbait, I think. Well... Yeah, no, it is. It is the worst form because it literally builds my hopes up, hands them a cookie, picks them up as if they're going to get cradled in your arms, and then dashes them across the rocks.
So. I like how every single comment on this article, though, is calling them out for being full of it.
Yeah, on their own site. So the only people that are reading the Mirror online are people that are slamming the Mirror online. You jerks. Is the source just that guy that you heard on his way down the hallway saying, wouldn't it be great if...
I think we're the source.
Us.
I heard it on this podcast.
All three of our listeners. Well, so there you go. So the highs, the lows, the good, the bad, and the ugly in today's news.
To all of our listeners at the Mirror, we appreciate your patronage.
I don't. Come at me, bro. Well, Jay obviously couldn't be with us this evening, but I'm going to be handing everything back over to him as I will not be in for next week. I'm still hoping to circle around and see some of our listeners and fellow Whovians down in Atlanta for Dragon Con. We'll be hitting the ground for the full festivities all the way from first Friday through second Sunday. So all 5 days of the weekend. Oh,
messed up calendar system they got going down there in Georgia.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's just, yeah. They name all the days the same, and all the streets are named Peachtree. So there you go. They keep it simple. But Jay and Haley will be reconvening next week for our classic rewatch, where they're getting to the Dominators.
Is that a good
thing? I love the story.
Okay.
Some of the weirdest props. The quarks. Ugh.
You'll have to send us your feedback live from Dragon Con.
Oh, I will. Yeah, I'll be sure to do that. I can't imagine what I could possibly send you. I might do it. I'll see if you can make out what's being said as I'm standing in the middle of the Marriott floor surrounded by 20,000 screaming people in cosplay. More power to you.
Okay.
Have at it. But this is a great story. It's obviously it's Jamie and Zoe companion story as well. So great dynamic there. And it's actually a really interesting premise with the whole idea of balance of power and warfare and warmongering and so forth. So you got a lot to dig in there. So it's a complete story, so we don't have to deal with any more reconstructions.
No, it's so much fun. I don't know what the complaints are.
Yeah, what could possibly? And the costumes alone, you'll love them. Just enjoy. On all technical levels, this is a fun one. And you remember we did watch The Mind Robber, right? Did you see The Mind Robber?
I don't remember. What happened to The Mind Robber?
The Mind Robber was the whole Land of Fiction.
I don't know
if you remember. It was dealing with the master brain. There was the guy who had his bodysuit looked like Attack on Titan. It was just like exposed musculature.
I have no memory of this. That doesn't mean we didn't watch it, but I have no memory at all of what you're talking about.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll probably be getting to it as well, because I think that is a complete story. So we'll be able to enjoy that in a classic rewatch coming up. But please remember, folks, we are closing in on our 200th. Some people consider that to be kind of a nice round number. So if you've got anything you want to chime in with us, let us know whether we are doing our jobs or should completely rethink this and start redoing this as a drunk cast or something of that sort. By the way, if you have not listened to Dr. Hooch, I don't do other podcast plugs very often, but Dr. Hooch is awesome. I love these kids to death. I plan on guesting. I'm inviting myself on as a guest because I love Dr. Who and I love booze. So I think it's only fitting. So, but yes, yeah, we will be soliciting folks to share their thoughts on how GPR has been doing for the past 5 years and 200 episodes. You can just either shoot us a note electronically through all the various media or give us a call. Head over to the website, GallifreyPublicRadio.com, and you can click right into the voicemail. Even if you don't have a phone, you can do it all through the power and the magic of the interwebs.
What witchcraft is this?
It is. There's sorcery afoot. But
madness.
But yeah. So that's about the wrap up. You have just survived what has been episode 198 of Gallifrey Public Radio. So until next week, this is Kier saying, if you hear my voice in the next 2 weeks, please excuse anything that I am quoted as saying due to lack of sleep and or inebriation.
And this is Haley saying, look at these people, these human beings. Consider their potential. From the day they arrive on the planet, blinking, step into the sun. There is more to see than can ever be seen. More to do than... No, hold on. Sorry. That's the Lion King.
Night, kids.
Bye.
Annoncy.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio or on Facebook @facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows. Or visit forums.gungeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2016.
I got this cross-eyed cat staring at me from the floor.
I think mine's in the window right now.
I don't know. I saw it crawling across the back of the couch. Oh, no, it's, you got one asleep on the back of the couch.
Oh, she
you.
Came back. Yep.
Well, Guy is having some sort of inner ear imbalance issues, and the fact that he can't, like, reach things when he jumps for them makes it so that he's more comfortable when he looks at you upside down. So he'll lay down and invert his head, because I think the wiring in his brain actually has him seeing things reversed. But, yeah, I get to abandon him. I get a vacation from this cat.
Aww.
For 5 days. Yeah. Shut up, guys.